Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Deb Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If the long slog of building a new and more positive Middle East is still well underway, it's hard to notice it amid the headlines about ethnic rioting, iron fist clampdowns in Syria and Bahrain, and the machinations of Saudi kings. So where's it all headed? This hour, On Point, a progress report on the Arab Spring. You can join the conversation. Is it time to despair once again for the Middle East, or are we just witnessing a difficult transition to democracy after years of oppression? You can also comment on our website at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now, our guest from Rome, is Michael Wahid Hanna. He's a fellow and program officer at the Century Foundation. And joining us from Colchester, Vermont, is Gregory Gauss, professor of political science at the University of Vermont and until recently director of the Middle East Studies Program there. Welcome, gentlemen, to the program.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Michael, I want to start with you. News is not great in Cairo. The revolution seems quite stalled there with sectarian tensions, Muslims and Coptic Christians shooting at each other. How can Egyptians pay attention to this crucial election that comes up in September when there's still all the shooting on the streets?
Well, clearly we're witnessing a transition from protest to politics, and it is clearly not very seamless. There is still a security vacuum in Egypt. The military is trying to police,
okay,
but is not very good at it.
Michael, I'm going to hold you right there. We have a very bad line. Sometimes it's easier to call Cairo than it is Rome. And let me go to Greg Gauss and ask, Greg, do you think that that Michael's right? The little bit that I could hear, he said, we're moving from protest to politics, and that's hard. And do you think that explains why it is so difficult to get Egyptians to pay attention to the elections and stop shooting each other in the streets?
I think we're moving to politics and not leaving protests. And I think that that's going to be particularly hard. Egypt, I think, has a good chance of a democratic transition. I'm not sure that we in the United States are going to like the government that gets produced by that democratic transition. But Egypt and Tunisia, the Arab countries, are the ones that I think probably have the best shot at this. They're the most homogeneous. They have the fewest number of internal tensions in terms of ethnic or sectarian differences. I'm not saying that they don't exist, but they pale in comparison to the kind of problems and divisions that we see in other Arab countries.
And let's move this step to another country, and that's Libya. Today in the paper, the top military commander there, the Brit, is quoted as saying that the Libyan leader could cling to power unless NATO broadens bombing targets. What he's talking about is taking out electricity in Tripoli. Does it matter to the other uprisings whether Gaddafi stays or whether he goes?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there's a dynamic in each of these countries. Obviously, there's also a regional dynamic, or else we wouldn't have seen all these things happening at the same time. But I think that that regional dynamic is starting to die down a bit, and the particularities of each country are starting to take over. Certainly, we've seen in Bahrain and in Yemen that quick success is not a given when you have popular uprisings. And so the momentum of Tunisia and then Egypt has kind of slowed down. And I think that we're seeing that in Syria, we're seeing it in Libya, as the particularities of each of these countries come into play, and that kind of wave of optimism about being able to remove autocratic leaders relatively easily dissipates.
Also, that raises a question about policy. We have a comment from Viv Sterling, and this is a web Facebook page comment. The Arab Spring seems to be teetering. Egypt is having internal friction, and Syria and Yemen seem to have a free hand to quash dissent. And she writes, I don't see the U.S. intervening in those countries. Does this also raise questions about policy? One size does not fit all, and I think many, in the public want to see one size fit all in terms of policy. Do you think it can?
Well, it's easy to develop a one size fits all narrative. It looks good in the newspapers, and it looks good in presidential speeches, one of which we'll be getting later on this week. But I really think that the countries themselves are so different, and the extent of American influence in the countries is so varied that one size fits all would be an extremely difficult policy to pursue if we wanted to get practical and real results in these countries.
We sort of framed this hour as we were going to have a report card on the progress of the revolutions. And I have heard people complain that the way that the news has been done over the past couple of weeks, it's all about detail. Yet another battle in Libya, yet another crackdown in Bahrain or Syria. Is there something now, General, that you can say broadly about how the Arab Spring revolutions are progressing?
No, I don't think so. We've got two cases where long-sitting autocrats were removed, but they were removed not just by popular pressure, but by the fact that they lost control of their militaries. And their militaries, which retained a kind of a corporate identity and a unity as an institution, in effect ushered those guys out. And so the militaries remain in Egypt and Tunisia, and they're part of the old system, much more so in Egypt than in Tunisia. In other places like Libya and Syria and Yemen and Bahrain, you had militaries that, for reasons of ethnic solidarity or regional solidarity or because family members control important units, you've had militaries that at least part of them have stuck with the autocrats. And if you're going to have the military sticking with the autocrats, it's going to be very difficult to remove those autocrats, because in the two cases where it worked, Tunisia and Egypt, it was the military that ushered them out.
And so does this mean, Greg, that we're not going to see the new Middle East? All of that optimism, I think, that people felt as they watched the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt is a bit tempered today, don't you think?
Well, what happened in Egypt and Tunisia are great stories for those of us in the West who believe that democracy can work anywhere in the world, that it's a kind of a single template that you can put down anywhere. I think that, as I said, Tunisia and Egypt have really good chances of forming democratic governments. But those democratic governments are going to surprise people in the West, are going to surprise people who saw the kids, quote unquote, in Tahrir Square, you know, marshaling a huge demonstrations against the regime. The kids aren't going to run these governments. Organized political forces, many of them Islamist, are going to do very well in these elections. And some elements of the old regime, like the army in Egypt, are going to have a big say in what happens. So it's going to be messy. It's going to be disappointing to outside observers and to many people in these countries who also hold these very high hopes. And those are the cases where you might have real change. Look at a place like Bahrain, where the crackdown on what had been a peaceful protest and a crackdown supported by foreign troops, with Saudis, Emiratis, Kuwaitis, Qataris coming in to support the Bahraini monarchy. I mean, that has soured politics in Bahrain, I think, maybe for as much as a generation. We'll see.
We have Michael Waheed Hanna back on the phone. Michael, are you a little bit more optimistic? It is often said that what happens in Egypt matters to the rest of the region. Do you see that as Egypt comes to terms with its revolution, perhaps produces a more democratic government, that does spill over to the rest of the region?
Well, I think certainly the emergence of regional norms are incredibly important in terms of being able to support the democratization of countries. And Egypt obviously is the largest Arab country, has traditionally played the lead diplomatic role, although it has abdicated that role in decades with the sort of stagnation of the Mubarak regime. So it has outsized influence in the region. Obviously, the particularities of specific countries matter a great deal, but the example of Egypt, whether good or bad, is going to have reverberations for a long time to come. And that's why there's a sense for not just Egyptians, but many in the West and many in the region, really, that the transition has to go well. It has to go right because of all of these expectations and all of these other countries looking at the example of Egypt. You know, on a broader level, you know, we're only several months into this transition, and it's probably somewhat unfair to be drawing far-reaching conclusions at this point. These are fundamental changes to the political order of a place like Egypt and to the political consciousness of the citizenry. And I think these are things that are going to be working themselves out for decades to come, frankly. So, you know, the scope of our inquiry at this point might be too limited, and obviously that's the only thing we have to go off of at this point. But these are things that are going to be developing and changing within Egyptian society, and you know, the emergence of a new social compact. These are things that are going to take years and perhaps decades.
You're talking internally, but do you think that Greg is right that we're not going to exactly like what a democratic Egypt might throw at us?
Well, clearly, it's a more difficult relationship. I think the United States has long taken for granted the sort of automatic support of the Mubarak regime. There was a sort of implicit bargain that had been struck. And in particularly in the later years of the regime, when regime succession and survival became the heightened concern for all involved, Egypt was certainly not a very dynamic diplomatic player. And so it didn't play a major role, and it often acquiesced to U.S. policy goals in the region.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're taking stock of the good and the bad in the headlines out of the Middle East and trying to figure out if the Arab Spring can live up to its promise. My guests are Michael Wahid Hanna, fellow and program officer at the Century Foundation. He joins us from Rome. And joining us from Colchester, Vermont, is Gregory Gause, professor of political science at the University of Vermont. Gregory, I wanted to ask about a particular headline. I know we said we weren't going to do this, but from Syria. Yesterday, the Syrians seem to have allowed Palestinian refugees who live there to get very close to the Israeli border up on the Golan Heights. That's very new for that relationship. That border has been quiet for 30 years. Tell us what you think that that's about.
Well, I think that it's a reflection of the fact that immediately, this regime knows it's in trouble, and it's trying to appeal to broader sentiments on Arab-Israeli questions that might divert attention from its own problems and its own misgovernment of Syria. But I think it's also a longer-term indication that as regimes in the Arab world become more democratic and care more about what their public opinion says, they're going to take positions on the Arab-Israeli question that we're not going to like that much, because the Palestinian issue remains a very popular issue in the Arab world, and support for Palestinians really does cross borders. You know, none of these revolutions that were made, if we can call them revolutions, upheavals, revolts, none of them were made in the name of Palestine. But that doesn't mean that these new governments aren't going to have foreign policies and aren't going to have to deal with Arab-Israeli questions, and public opinion will play a much greater role in how they deal with the Arab-Israeli question than it has in the past. I mean, Michael said that the Mubarak regime, we had a deal with the Mubarak regime, right? You do what we want on foreign policy issues, we'll give you money, and we won't bother you that much about what you do at home. That deal is now off. And it does seem to me that we are going to see an Egyptian foreign policy that is more problematic on Arab-Israeli questions from our point of view, from an American point of view, than we've seen in the past.
Let me make 2 points, and then I want to go to Michael. And the first is that Egypt actually is supporting the Syrian regime and said so a few weeks ago. We have a note from a Facebook page. Amin Sabah says, "The Arabs are dwelling in possibilities. The fear barrier is somewhat down. The bet is on the will of the people to push for reform." And here's the interesting thing. But how the Western world and its media package, how they respond to events in Syria will be crucial. Michael Hanna, do you think it matters how the Western press covers, let's say, the Syrian uprising, which has been the most problematic, as has been Bahrain, because they don't let Western reporters in?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Syria, you're dealing with a much different situation than, say, Egypt, where there were clear levers of influence, outside access, a country that cared somewhat about its reputation in the world, and that's something that I think ran through the minds of military leaders. And we had open communication with Egyptian military leaders. And those types of levers of influence don't exist with Syria. And so I think it's a much broader issue than simply how a uprising is covered. This isn't a media exercise. What fundamentally tipped the balance in Egypt was internal decision-making. It was the millions of people in the street that had very little to do with whether the United States was for or against their movement, and the decisions of Egyptian military leaders who saw a possibility for preserving their own power untethered from the Mubarak regime. The interaction with the United States and the rest of the world is important, but it doesn't fundamentally change the internal balance of power that in the end is what decides the fate of these uprisings. And so it's important for the rest of the world to know what's going on, but particularly with Syria, there aren't very many ways for the United States and other countries to influence the trajectory of events.
We're going to go to a caller from Williamsburg, Kentucky. Jim, you're writing that you're concerned about the uprising and relations with Israel. Why so?
Hi, Deborah. My concern is that the elephant in the room here is Israel. And I see a pattern taking place, which kind of reminds me of some things that were going on during Saddam Hussein's time. Israel is a great lightning rod to deflect the heat of dissatisfactions away from internal problems. And I see also in Egypt the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Those people scare the daylights out of me.
Let me talk to Greg about that. As we all know, in the early days of the Tunisia uprising and certainly in Egypt, nobody was talking about Israel. Do you think it's fair to talk about it now?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's one of America's big interests in the Middle East. Whether you like American policy on Arab-Israeli questions or you think it needs some change, one thing that's absolutely certain is that the United States is going to have a strong relationship with Israel down the road. And thus, the effect of Arab uprisings on the Arab-Israeli dynamic is something that everybody in Washington is going to be concerned about. The closer a state is to Israel's borders, the more important it is. Right? What happens in Tunisia may be not so central. What happens in Egypt and Syria and Jordan, really important in terms of Arab-Israeli issues. So that is something that undoubtedly is going to be factored in to Washington decision-making on these questions.
Greg, I want to raise another country equally as important as Israel to the region, and that is Saudi Arabia. They have taken a different approach to the Arab uprisings. They don't like them. They think that they are against stability and, in fact, were almost broke relations with the United States because we didn't support Hosni Mubarak in Egypt after a 30-year relationship. How much of a role do you think that they play as time goes on in which of the Arab uprisings succeed and which don't?
Well, the statement that the Saudis don't like the Arab uprisings is a grand understatement. They really hate them. The Saudis have seen upheaval in Iraq and the institution of a democratic system lead to a government that they see as sectarian, Shia-dominated, and closely allied with Iraq. I'm sorry, closely allied with Iran. They were not going to let that happen in Bahrain. And so they could care less about democracy, and they encouraged those elements in the ruling family in Bahrain who wanted to suppress the peaceful demonstrations for political reform, and then they sent in their own troops to help support that. Saudi influence, I think, is greatest, closest to their borders in the smaller Gulf monarchies and in Yemen, where the Saudis are the outside power with the most influence to affect events. Once you get outside of that, I think that Saudi influence dissipates. Ideologically, they have some ties with the Salafi Muslim movements that are gaining prominence in Egypt. You know, these people tend to be rivals of the Muslim Brotherhood. We could talk for hours about the Salafis and what they are and all, but just suffice it to say that their very strict scripturalist interpretation of Islam leads them to, shall we say, very illiberal positions on all sorts of things. And I think once you get out into North Africa, much less. The Saudis are trying to bring the other monarchies closer to them, Morocco and Jordan, through an invitation to join the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is kind of ironic given that Morocco is nowhere near the Persian Gulf. But no, the Saudis are a force against democratic change in the Middle East.
And let me bring Michael Hanna into this discussion, and that is what the Egyptians now say is we want to relook at foreign policy. We are now past the Mubarak era. We want to perhaps have a better relationship with Iran. And I wondered how much Saudi influence will curtail that new opening.
Well, I mean, the axis, the Egyptian-Saudi axis is incredibly important for foreign policy making in the region. With respect to Iran, obviously, much of Saudi thinking about internal change region-wide is filtered through their prism of what is emerging as a more heated rivalry with Iran. And so every step is calculated with respect to this broader emerging conflict. Egypt's position with Iran has been traditionally particularly hostile. And it was one of three countries, the United States and Israel, and Egypt were the three countries that did not have relations with Iran. Ironically, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries that are expressing the most disquiet about the possibility of Egypt reestablishing normalized relations with the Iranians all have normal relations with Iran. They have ambassadors there. So from the Egyptian perspective, they're looking at trying to become a more influential diplomatic player and also trying to cut down on unnecessary hostility. And they point very clearly to the fact that all these Gulf countries also have relations with Iran. So it's not a meeting of the minds between Egypt and Iran, as opposed to simply a recognition that they are neither enemy nor friend, but that in the course of normal diplomatic relations, this is the way that countries deal with disputes. And so it is obviously a turn away from the more confrontational approach of the Mubarak regime, and the Saudis had come to rely on that. And what they saw as a sort of Sunni alliance against the expansion of Iranian influence, particularly after the overthrow of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, the traditional rivals of Iran. And so this has unsettled Iran, but I think the unsettled Saudi Arabia, pardon. But I think there's a fundamental misreading of the role of Iran in the region. And I think this is leading the Saudis to some hasty conclusions and perhaps ratcheting up the level of conflict to a degree that might allow actually much more direct conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran in the near future.
I'd like to bring a third voice into this conversation at this point, and that's Tarek Youssef, and he's the dean of the Dubai School of Government. He's also head of the Middle East Project there, and he's paid close attention to the youth demographic in the Middle East, which arguably started the whole Arab Spring in the first place. He joins us today from Doha. Hi.
Hello.
Tarek, have you been listening to our two analysts argue about where Iran fits and Saudi Arabia? And you are out there. Are you feeling this tension in the region? We're talking about an Arab Spring, but there's also a pretty cold winter that's happening between Iran and its neighbors. Are you feeling that winter there?
Absolutely. I'm feeling it, I'm hearing it, and I'm seeing signs of escalation of diplomatic isolation, pressure on other countries to further isolate Iran, and escalation in perceptions of Iran's intentions vis-a-vis the Gulf and perhaps the rest of the Arab world. This is a bit perplexing to some extent because little has changed in the last few months to suggest that Iran's intentions have at least overtly or explicitly changed. And most of the action, most of the dynamics we've seen in the region recently have been driven by the Arab Spring. So Iran is possibly getting caught up in this, and I think the countries that have the most reservation on Iran's intentions or its potential role in the future, whether a threat or that as a rival to Saudi Arabia, are essentially positioning themselves for the future, preempting perhaps the emergence of an alliance or even more normalized relations between Iran and some of the countries that have undergone change in the Arab world. There is no reason necessarily to think that Egypt and Iran will become close allies instead of just simple, as one of the guests suggested, simple diplomatic, normal, constructive relations.
Tarek, that is how it looks in the Gulf. When you come further towards Egypt, now we have two Arab monarchies, Jordan and Morocco, being asked to join with the other oil-rich monarchies in the Gulf, the GCC. Almost as soon as that happened, Jordan seemed to talk like a Saudi monarch, said that wanted stability in Syria. And I wondered if there was now almost this wall between the monarchs in the Gulf and now moving further west with Jordan and Morocco and the republics that are in the middle of tumult?
Very possibly. And I think, again, there is more by way of rhetoric here and perhaps wishful thinking and reactive statements and propositions than concrete steps on the ground. I don't necessarily see the possibility soon of Morocco and Jordan becoming an integrated part of the Gulf for economic, institutional, and a host of other reasons. But politically, it would appear to be the case that, in fact, the Arab monarchies, the so-called stable countries that have more legitimacy than the republics that are facing the test of illegitimacy on the streets and the uprisings, are essentially trying to create a fence around them, one that distinguishes them, differentiates them from the rest of the region, and perhaps allows them to reestablish a new Arab order. I am of the mind that the Arab order as we knew it through the end of 2010 is probably broken now, and it's time to imagine new alliances, new coalitions, not only within the countries that have gone through change, but across the countries of the region. This battle is going to be on for some time to come, but it's not clear to me yet that, in fact, it's going to be Morocco and Jordan joining with others necessarily. That will be the case. Perhaps some other reconfigurations will emerge once Egypt becomes more stable, once Tunisia becomes more stable. We saw Algeria react rather aggressively yesterday to the invitation to Morocco and Jordan, and we saw others essentially calling for the obituary of the Arab League as we knew it. So there is a fundamental shift possibly happening down the line, but we're not there yet, and it seems to me most countries are positioning themselves, reacting in a way to try to fence at least the area of stability that they enjoy at the moment.
Greg, quickly, as we end this segment, let me ask you this. As I listen to Tarek, it seems like the Gulf states are as confused as Washington over what to do as the Arab world goes through this phase.
Oh, I think they're extremely confused. I think that they look to Morocco and Jordan as a way to try to solidify monarchy as a regime type. But I think the Moroccans and the Jordanians are looking to the Gulf as sources of funding to try to support their regimes. I don't think that they can do much to help the Gulf states with their own problems.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're doing a progress report on the Arab Spring. You can join the conversation. With President Obama due to give a major speech on the Middle East on Thursday, do you think there is something the U.S. can do or say to help the Arab Spring along, or should we just stand back and stay out of the way? My guests are Michael Waheed Hanna, a fellow at the Century Foundation, Gregory Gause, professor of political science at the University of Vermont, and Tarek Youssef, dean of the Dubai School of Government and head of the Middle East Youth Project there. Before we get to the president's speech, Tarek, I wanted to talk to you about the youth bulge. 60% of the population in the Middle East is under 30. And there's a paradox with this generation. The more educated you are, the more likely that you will be unemployed. Tell us about that.
I think we've been following this paradox over the last 20 years, precisely as you suggested. As more and more cohorts of young men and women came of age in the Arab world, they became more educated, but their job opportunities became more dismal. And in fact, across the region, whether rich or poor, countries have not been able to create enough jobs to employ gainfully on a high quality, sustained level, these cohorts of highly educated young men and women. This paradox is due to a host of institutional and structural issues, meaning this is not just about money being thrown at the problem, nor is it about tinkering with smaller changes on the margin, a job creation program here or a micro enterprise program there. This is about fixing the institutions that govern and shape the economy, shape the incentives, the role of government as an employer, the role of the private sector, the role of the global economy, the role of financial markets. These are the impediments. There are blockages there. There are structural impediments there. There are obstacles to allowing markets to operate freely, dynamically, and absorb these cohorts, and quite frankly, turn them not just into engines of growth and engines of transformation, but engines of prosperity for most societies in the region. That is the crux of this problem. Now that the Arab Spring has unleashed these forces on the political sphere, expectations have only become more heightened on the possibilities for change, on the possibilities for reform, and on the possible realization for a changed course of action. That is the challenge at the moment that I think these countries in transition face.
And Greg, do you think that that these countries can address that problem? At the moment, it's not even on the agenda.
It is not on the agenda. I think at this moment, most of these countries are trying to come up with a new blueprint, one that fits the momentous and dramatic change in the policy configuration in these countries, one that addresses the strong political calls for change. But very soon, there will also be calls for economic prosperity, for economic gains, not just for the youth, but for most of the excluded segments of the population. And my fear, for example, looking at a country like Egypt today, is that Egypt is fighting to maintain economic stability, when in fact what it needs is a wholesale economic transformation program for which it has no economic or financial resources, and where the outside world, namely Europe and the U.S., are either sitting on the sideline or approaching it very hesitantly. That also is the danger in this moment, that if we don't address Egypt's need to become stable quickly so that it can begin to address the questions of the future, these revolutions can become very destabilizing forces, very, very volatile, and with a host of unpredictable social and political consequences.
And let me ask Greg Gauss, is that what the president should talk about on Thursday? Do we have a responsibility as the United States government to give money?
Here's the problem. Egypt and Tunisia are the two countries in the Arab world that went the furthest in many ways in opening up their economies, in privatizing state enterprises, in opening to the global, to the processes of globalization. Now, these were half-hearted in many ways and very politicized privatizations, crony capitalism. But I think it's given, if you will, the Washington consensus, that package of economic policies that the United States has always tried to encourage developing economies to pursue, at least in the last 30 or 40 years. It's given that a very bad name for Arab rulers, right? If we follow what you say, they'll say to Washington, we'll go the way of Mubarak and Ben Ali. And thus, I fear that what you're going to see in Egypt and Tunisia and other parts of the Arab world is an attempt to revert to an older social contract where the state played a much greater role in the economy, assured kind of a basic economic, if you will, almost survival level economic standard for people in exchange for their political quiescence. As Tariq said, I don't think that Egypt and Tunisia have the resources to maintain that kind of system now. But I also don't think that they have and the political elites that will emerge in these places reacting to populist politics are going to have a blueprint for how to deal with these issues.
Let's go to a caller. Hunter is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hunter?
Hi, Deborah. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Excellent. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I was actually in Egypt. I was in Cairo, in fact, when the revolution first hit. I was supposed to be studying Arabic there with American University in Cairo, and I ended up getting evacuated. But before I left, I did get to see at least one of the protests, and I guess two things come to mind as regards the current debate vis-a-vis the Arab Spring. First off, the spirit of cooperation and hospitality I saw on the part of the Egyptian people was incredible. I mean, I saw everyone there at the protests. I saw women, I saw men, I saw Christians, I saw Muslims, I saw old people, I saw children. And I think the hearts of the Egyptian people, I mean, I can't speak for the rest of the Middle East, but I think those are in the right place. But also, you know, it didn't take us, I mean, when we in America first had our revolution, I mean, it's not like we, you know, we're able to pull a functioning democracy out of a hat in a couple months. I mean, and this is an ongoing process. One could argue that we still haven't assured a functioning democracy. So I guess I just wanted to say I think it's a little unfair for us to expect these countries to just, you know, become overnight successful working democracies. I mean, there's going to be trial and error.
Let me go to Michael Hanna and ask if he agrees that we are being too hard, that it is going to take a while. But at the same time, is there a time clock for young revolutionaries who went out for freedom but also went out for jobs?
Well, I mean, clearly, it would be preposterous to think that you could set up a new democratic system with robust institutions in a matter of months. But obviously for the rest of the region and the world, what happens in Egypt matters. And so patience has its limits. For the United States, it's a close ally. It's been a linchpin of American foreign policy. And so there is anxiety about the direction of Egypt. For the rest of the region looking on, there are also concerns about the economic stability of the country. And two things on the economic front with respect to Egypt. The crony capitalism that grew up, particularly in the past 10 years, part of the dissatisfaction that sprung on that basis was the immense corruption that it spawned. And so you have an association in people's mind with the flamboyant corruption of the past decade with these economic policies. And now there is no shared economic agenda. You see continued labor strikes pointing to, as Greg pointed out, perhaps a more statist model of economics. And there's very little vision about how to meld these different currents into a functioning economic policy. And so, time is not in the favor of Egyptians on that front. And so it's understandable that onlookers are nervous about what is an unsteady transition at the moment.
Let's go to another caller. Megan is calling from Ames, Iowa. Hi, Megan.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because I haven't heard very many people talk about the fact that I guess I'm questioning whether or not this kind of development of democracy is a new type of colonization, or if it's kind of looked at that way, or if it is actually us trying to kind of work our way into these places and have a mimicry kind of effect so that we can have a hold there.
All right. I'll ask Tarek if he thinks that people actually do want democracy in the region. But also, I want you to address the president's speech this week. Is there anything that he can say that makes a difference in the region?
On the first question, I am of the mind or of the view, and I have seen significant, consistent evidence for this, not just in the Arab Spring, but in surveys of public opinion that have been done in the region in the last 5 years, that suggest that the people of the region want to be better governed. Now, that might encompass some of the ideas we associate with Western-style democracy, but it may not necessarily do so. But it certainly would include such components as the rule of law, transparency, accountability. These were the Arabic phrases that were raised in Egypt, in the streets of Cairo, and throughout the region, have become right now a part of the public discourse on what the region needs to accomplish in terms of a political system and a way of also governing economic and social life in the future. Better governance, good governance, accountability, transparency. And I think those are the things we can help the Egyptians and the Tunisians with by helping them to stabilize at least the areas where they are most vulnerable at the moment. I think the president may not necessarily be in a position to offer a blueprint. And I agree with Greg and Mike that, in fact, the world community at this moment can no longer offer a framework for how you manage economics and manage globalization and manage politics in the way that we could have done just 10 years ago. We're also battling these issues in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. But what we can do, at least, is to offer these countries a chance, and hence the call for help for Egypt to become stable financially right now, to be able to perform basic public functions, to stabilize its external accounts, to pay salaries. The same for Tunisia and perhaps other countries. At minimum, what we can do here is to offer the ingredients for them to begin a national dialogue on what they would want for themselves in the next decade or two. I don't have a blueprint. I don't think anyone has a monopoly on the blueprint or knows what would be the right constellation of policies and issues. But I think the president, being the visionary person that he is, can reflect most genuinely and honestly and offer, of course, on the table some concrete proposals for what the United States and the world community plans to do to support these countries during the transition.
We're going to go to another call from Plymouth, Massachusetts, Esla.
Hi, Deborah. Yeah, I am originally from Egypt, and I would just like to comment on the United States policies in the Middle East. We really have to prove ourselves to the Middle East that America really supports democracy, because for decades, America talked about democracy and supported dictators.
So that's what the president has to say, you think, on Thursday.
Exactly. And also the blind tightness with Israel unconditionally all the time hurts our position in the Middle East.
All right, let me ask our analyst here. Greg Gause, do you think that the president has to address Israel in this speech or has to address the Arab Spring?
Well, I think he's going to address a lot of things, and I think that that might be a problem. I'm not sure that the United States can do that much to improve the situation in the Arab world. I agree with Tariq. If you're talking about currency stabilizations, preventing the collapse of the Egyptian currency, yeah, we can step in the way we did in other places, the way the EU is stepping in its own countries like Portugal and Greece. We can try to do that to prevent complete breakdown. But it seems to me that the United States for the last 15 years in the greater Middle East has made it its project to change the domestic politics of these countries. Afghanistan and Iraq by force. Other places with talk about democratization and not always support. It seems to me that this might be a time to reflect and step back and say Arabs have to decide these things themselves. I think that there's a lot of virtue to pushing for Arab-Israeli peace for a wide range of reasons. But unfortunately, the situation is not particularly conducive on the ground. You have a right-wing Israeli government that's not amenable to territorial compromise. You have a Palestinian government that, despite its recent agreement between Fatah and Hamas, remains divided. I don't know if there's that much the U.S. can do in the short term on Arab-Israeli issues.
And Michael, is there anything that if you could get into the president and put at least a page in that speech, would you tell him this is what you have to say?
Well, I mean, I think the previous points are well taken, and there is some skepticism about the U.S. role, past support for authoritarianism in the region, and frankly, one speech can't overcome 30 years of support from Mubarak, and this is something that's going to take time. But I think laying forth a clear commitment to these emerging democratic politics and the results, because the results might be uncomfortable for us. As we saw with Hamas's election several years ago, this proved too much for the United States and was particularly problematic for the United States' democracy agenda in the region, because for many Arabs, it looked as if the United States was insincere about democratization. Democratization was okay so long as our allies won. And so I think that's an important point to make, that the United States is committed to this evolving process, and we will be ready to deal with the governments that emerge. Obviously, that's not carte blanche to say that these governments could espouse any policy and expect U.S. support, but perhaps a more greater patience and understanding about the emerging politics of the region.
Thanks, all of you gentlemen. Very interesting conversation. My guests are Michael Waheed Hanna with the Century Foundation, Greg Gause, professor of political science at the University of Vermont, and Tarek Youssef, dean of the Dubai School of Government, head of the Middle East Youth Project there. You can continue the conversation and get On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Deborah Amos, and I'm in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.